I always think that when you have some of these outages, they'll go and blame the security tool. See, we shouldn't have ever used these things. What the fudge? What's going on? And then we have to go play, we CISOs or security leaders have to go play a role of educating folks and explaining to them what we just went through.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? It's time to get adversarial.
Hey guys, welcome back. It's good to see you as always on the podcast. Hope you had a good Thanksgiving, and it's nice to be back in the seat here. Mario, you look like you're in San Francisco. I'm back in Atlanta as usual, but Sunil, you look like you're in some fancy hotel room in Dubai or something. Where are you?
Actually, that's not too far away. But yeah, fancy hotel room for sure. I'm in Istanbul.
Ooh. Oh, really?
Yeah.
that wasn't even in my top five guesses.
Well, you got Middle East, you know, generally speaking. Although it's, being Istanbul, I'm actually on the European side, not the Asian side. But it is nonetheless in that general vicinity. And I got an upgrade too. So it is, so this particular hotel, it's kind of interesting. There's an elevator. There's a private elevator right outside my door, and it goes up to, so my current floor is the highest floor, but it goes up, and it goes up to a helipad. So I was like, okay, there's some interesting people who must stay here.
Well, kudos to you as a funded founder for mentioning that you got upgraded, and this way your backers aren't wondering what the hell's going on out there with their money.
That's right.
I'm thinking of that late 80s.
I'm sorry, not only that, but this was a courtesy hotel from Turkish Airlines. I'm not paying. Our restaurants aren't paying. I'm not even paying for this.
Let's be 100% clear. Awesome.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of that late 80s song from They Might Be Giants. Istanbul was once Constantinople.
Yep. How could you not? That's what's in my head all the time. Yes. Well, good. Well, let's jump right into it. We've had a little time, so we got some things queued up. There's been a lot of cybersecurity activity as usual, and we bridge over an AI all the time, and that's not slowing down at all. Kicking off with some Intel-based stuff. This is definitely a fire drill in a lot of the worlds I run in, some of which are the same ones you guys run in. The Shai-Hulud 2.0. As we call it, so some NPM packages backdoored again, brought down when executed locally, scanning for secrets and exfiltrating them. This is the second time this has happened in the last 6 months. Maybe it was only 3 months or so.
Well, much shorter.
Much shorter, right? Mm-hmm. I want to hear, what you guys saw as far as reactions to all of this, but it seems to me like the same thing can happen and the same company can act dramatically different about whether it's the end of the world or they don't even bother getting out of bed. How do you see people in the wild? And I could share a few too, but how have you seen people acting in the 12 hours following something like this?
Let's just go back to the timeline for a little bit. It was, I think, September when first shots were fired, so to speak, with NPM packages being compromised, and then subsequently the attacker using it was like two or three different command and control channels to be able to maintain some degree of persistent communications. Anyway, the point of that all is all just to say, back in September, the attacker showed some degree of cleverness in turning this type of an attack into a wormable attack and maintaining, constant communications with it. But it wasn't that successful, that first attempt. And so I think we in the security community said, oh, phew, we dodged that bullet. And certainly there were many other bullets. And by
the objective there was crypto, looking for crypto wallets, if I remember right, and hence the lack of success. Is that right?
Yeah. There were, but it also sucked down a whole bunch of developer creds and secrets and all that kind of stuff as well. Access tokens and whatnot. And granted, the targeting may have been specifically for crypto, but But once you have some of these other things, you can kind of do a lot of stuff with that, right? Anyway, the point I get is just generally speaking, we kind of collectively had the sigh of relief that it could have been so much worse, and it wasn't. but the technique that was used was still there, and we didn't really do much to defend against the technique. And so now with this second wave, so to speak, it was a bit more capable. It spread pretty fast and wide. And yeah, I mean, I was concerned because, you know, we develop some of our software in NPM. And it is extraordinarily hard to avoid some of these affected packages. I mean, there were hundreds of packages that were affected. And some of them, you know, they're not trivially small, right? They're significant in their own right. So anyway, it is something that everyone should have been paying attention to. And moreover, I think we have to figure out, okay, this is just round two. I suspect that there's going to be further rounds until we find some more systematic way to avoid this.
Yeah, I think that, look, whenever I want to get in a second, like if we're an average company, I always preach that there's like three types of things, entities. There's risks, incidents, and intelligence. I'm going to say a risk is something you've identified that might manifest, but it hasn't yet. An incident is something that has actually happened. And then an intel, and this is intel to me, is like when you get up and you hear about the tweet and, oh, we need to start looking for this. That's intelligence at that point. And it doesn't mean you're going to process any less reliably. You need to get on these things for sure. But I see some companies call that an incident. And I don't think that's a healthy behavior. Like among other things, you start splitting hairs with your customers later about your incident notifications and why you didn't tell them about this incident. Like, oh, it's not an incident. It's intelligence. You could build a system and track it if you want more rigor around it, sure. And then you look for this in your environment, like, oh yeah, wow, of course we use NPM, but like we actually bring down these packages. Now we have a risk and it's exfiltrated some secrets already to some GitHub repos. And oh, now we have an incident. Like each of those things sequentially, I think, are pretty important. And I think in any event, when you're done, you can't like knee-jerk react to the specific one. Like, let's go find all those packages and delete them or upgrade them or whatever it is. You got to step back. Like, what's the big picture? And going back to 1.0 and on this podcast, we were saying, or I'll say I was saying, in case you guys didn't agree with it, but that this, to the average executive who has like maybe a committee style exposure to software engineering, the whole notion of SOC 2, ISO, external audit and IT general controls, the whole kit and caboodle, all talking about change control and about segregation of duties and developers can't have access to prod and, oh, I want to make sure you're doing code reviews. They all should be paying attention back at 1.0 and certainly in 2.0 because the world is telling us over and over again, you automatically take code contributions from complete strangers across the world and slip them at least into live enterprise laptops and stuff and probably in many cases all the way into production. So everything we've been saying about segregation of duties and change control has been kind of a farce.
All right. Well, there are a couple of things. You used the terms risk, incident, and intelligence. And I'm actually pushing back on you on this, that I agree with two of those terms, but intelligence is this third term that you threw into it that seems to potentially, the way you described it, live left of boom and right of boom. My terminology around left of boom, right of boom, risk is something that you evaluate left of boom. It's left of boom because, well, you don't know if it's going to happen. Hence, that's why it's a risk, right? You once it actually happens, once it's been realized, it's no longer a risk. It's an actual incident, okay? The probability is 100% because it's happened, right? Intelligence is, in my view, it can fit into a couple of different aspects of what makes up risk. But generally speaking, intelligence, I would have put intelligence on the left of boom and thus a factor as a part of risk. But, you know, you might disagree. And I can see that you're trying to maybe also incorporate that into an incident, yeah. Maybe right of boom incident type of calibration as well.
Yeah. How do you, so, you know, let's put ourselves in our other colleagues' shoes. As, you know, some of us are entrepreneurs. We might not be doing CISO work as much as we used to. But how should we take that? How should our colleagues who are doing this, you know, operational work as CISOs in other companies should take this kind of information?
Well, I mean, I'll throw one thing out, right? I mean, the question is, yeah, like, what controls should they have implemented, or what can they do about this?
Right.
And I mean, I don't want to let perfect be the enemy of good. I think that's a threat in any of these things. So I'm going to give an incomplete, imperfect answer. And that is that external packages should have some embargo, like something in your pipeline that pulls things down. If it just said, delay updates for 10 days for new packages. Very imperfect. You could shoot holes in that all day, whatever. Now we're 2 for 2 for that having saved the day, right? Because especially in open source, people figure this stuff out within 10 minutes, 10 seconds, maybe certainly 10 days, and the whole world finds out. And not only are you aware of it, so maybe you could stop in and particularly black out a particular package, but they get pulled, right? I mean, even better. So it's kind of automated. You could do it all. So if there's one thing somebody could walk away with that's better than, you know, prattle on about it and make a big panic and run in circles until there's a new shiny object, it'd be that. And if either you know, have a suggestion of exactly how to do that in CI or whatever, and it's even more helpful to people, great. But at a minimum, I think that's right.
Because, I mean, you know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, there were a lot of startup companies who are trying to tackle this space. I mean, we don't need to name them, but they're also in a bunch of cemeteries of dead startups who never took off. And so everybody thought, you know, I bought into this. I was really concerned with it. I'll admit it, I went for that. I looked for companies that can help us out with that. But then it died. It seems like just now the focus is on something else. I mean, what do you guys think of that? Is this, are we just bound to revisit this? Are other companies going to come back and revisit this space? Go ahead, Sunil.
We have this general comment that we make, which is folks should practice the basics for that, you know, people don't do the basics. I think the question that I oftentimes, or the challenge I put forth to people is the basics constantly change. And they constantly adapt because the attacker is getting better, but we're also getting better as well, okay? So pinning known safe versions of open source packages, could you argue that's basics today? Maybe. You know, it's definitely a good practice, and it certainly helps you dodge some of these bullets that we're seeing. But, is that now such a practice that we should consider that to be part of the basics? Anyway, the point is that we throw around this term, the basics, all the time. And it's not really always clear what exactly are the basics, because pinning known safe versions, it only became, quote, a basics once we realized that people were attacking these packages and we're like, oh, shucks, we should do this. Now it's become the basics. But tell me again if I'm misleading people here, but I'm pretty sure that wouldn't have been considered the basics 5 years ago.
Wait, look, first of all, I hate this basics thing, right? Because we always get into that and it's like all the CISOs get together and roll their eyes at the rest of the world like these are basics, and we don't do them. And so they're not basic. So like package pinning, like you just said, well, now that's considered hygiene. And in the past, and before September, it wasn't. No one is doing it. Right. Like egress restriction to production, no one's doing it. So it's not basic. And I'm not saying everybody's stupid. I think that's always a wrong conclusion. I don't think you could call something the basics if it's too hard for most people to do.
I mean, I think the embargo thing that you were talking about.
Package pinning, same thing.
Yeah. I genuinely think that is, to me, makes sense. I've tried to practice that and I get steamrolled by the business. Hey, we got to move. We got to get this new package out there. What are you talking about? It's going to impact all these customers if we don't do this. And it's not because it might be because they need a new update because something's broken, right? But that new update potentially may be introducing new issues. I don't know how to, you see, as you're getting more updated packages, but if we do an embargo, a pinning, then we're slowing down that as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I think just the shift from default allow to default deny is 80-20 here. So if somebody came along and said, hey, man, there's an update in curses and I'm all over this. And this weekend I was playing with my home project and it has this awesome function. And I just did it, but we pinned the damn package here and I need to get it out today. Like, I can almost approve that right now. Like, you're thoughtful about it. You're intentional. It's one. The chances of a package being polluted are infinitely higher than the chances of a specific one that we pick out of the blue. So just moving to requiring intentionality alone is a big uplift.
Okay. So now you said something that's really important, though. That
lib curses? Is all...
No, no. Where the pinning and where it's happening, right? Because from what I recall, it was in one of the threat reports, there was a the percentage of OSs that were affected. I think like 75% were Linux, 24%. These are rough numbers, but something like 70%+ were Linux, 20-something% were Mac, and 1% were Windows. Okay, now why all this Linux is because it was the CI/CD runners, right? So that's it was pulling packages in your CI/CD pipeline, and you weren't pinning there. Okay, but even if you were pinning there and didn't pin it on the developer side, well, your developer workstation just got hosed. Okay.
Targeting with these backdoors right now.
Right. And what I thought was actually also quite interesting is let's assume that everyone's CI/CD is running in Linux. That means there's roughly about a 20-to-1 ratio of Macs to PCs in terms of developers. And if we've thought that our Macs were like safe, okay. Guess what?
yeah. Totally. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. They run code too, it turns out.
Oh yeah.
All right. Next topic in here. Thank God the gods of Cyber Armageddon have caught up with us. Another huge one very recently is a couple of JavaScript frameworks having major CVEs in them, remote code execution CVEs in React. There's two of them right back to back. And this, I mean, it looks to me like the next Log4j, right? In other words, something that just about everyone is running. And it was pretty ubiquitous, the impact here. I saw in the immediate aftermath, someone calculated on a cocktail napkin that 39% of cloud environments have this, particular package, and this was about React alone. And I thought just about everybody somewhere, any company of size, has someone that was running React somewhere public facing. Talking to, I think it'd be fine to share this. I try to keep the conversations in confidence, but this might actually be a marketing win for them, so they'd probably be really glad I shared it. But I was in a chat with Watchtower, and they're in the business of scanning for stuff, and they were scanning for versions. And they were saying that like 90% were actually
90%
vulnerable to this. And it could just be that the 39% probably came from like a Shodan dork, right? I would just guess like how did somebody come up with that data? I don't know. It could be more like 90% of companies that are active and up and maintained, therefore customers of Watchtower, something like that. But widespread impact. And breaking news here, thanks Tilson for sharing this with us, but like Cloudflare had an outage and they attributed it to, and this is on December 5th, they had an outage that they attributed to patching for this thing, which bundles a lot of stuff. Like one, hey, Cloudflare was impacted. That's a big deal. And then their systems, right? They're not patching the systems they CDN for. That's another business. They might have WAFed that. That'd be cool.
Mm-hmm.
But they managed, and they had this, and it's funny, I was just looking earlier today at some error message in our application and saw some 500s that I couldn't make sense of and didn't have the time to care too much. I wonder if that was actually related to it. But this goes like to exactly what we're talking about. Like, there's an operational cost to doing any of this uplift. No. And look, Cloudflare are really good at change control and really good at this. Otherwise, they'd have massive outages all the time. And they assessed, stop the presses, dudes. I know we normally don't do this kind of thing. We need to rock this one. And I would think in hindsight, they'd say, yeah, there was some collateral damage. It's a shame. It was worth it.
Wait, so did the outage, did Cloudflare, the infrastructure get impacted because of this mitigation? Or was it clients of Cloudflare because of the mitigation they implemented that were impacted? Can you clarify that?
The former, which created the latter. So the former was they made changes to their internal infrastructure, but as a result of that, going through them to get to their customers, their customers were impacted. People were getting 500 errors to browse.
There you go.
Cloudflare customers because of the infrastructure. I mean, I'm just literally reading. It's super breaking.
I think that the question that you're asking is as a baseline, let's just make sure people understand. Cloudflare, if you have a website behind Cloudflare, we generally have an expectation that Cloudflare is going to put in a WAF rule. And of course, there's ways to bypass the WAF rule, but you know they're going to do their basic due diligence to try to shield a good chunk of the internet from the rampant attacks that are happening right now. Okay, unfortunately, to your point, there was a small little mistake that presumably caused an outage. So the question is fundamentally, was that worth the trade-off? Okay. In the process of putting in a security control, some puppies died, okay? And that risk trade-off that we make is a trade-off that we make every day in any enterprise, because whenever we put in a new WAF role or a firewall role or some EDR signature or whatever, some business process dies. Someone's business process dies.
Yeah.
And they get upset and you know, come back yelling at us and saying, hey, why'd you let this happen? We're like,
that's right.
Hey, you know, we saved all these other puppies. I'm sorry, your puppy died. Okay.
Yep.
So I think for given the severity of this particular threat, I think it was a worthwhile sacrifice.
Yeah. I spoke a couple nights ago for Cloudflare at an event that they did. And the talk was about AI security, and we were talking about whether or not I thought I would never say this today, but agentic AI and whether or not it would be useful in defending in mitigation actions, right? So like quarantine a laptop. And the question was like, when are you going to trust AI to make decisions about quarantining a laptop? And I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I feel like I've been close to the situation of accidentally quarantining a lot of boxes. Like, I think that's like part of your growing up in security. Sooner or later, you do that. Oops. And that just means, cool, now you actually have the ability to quarantine laptops. Because until you screw everything up, you didn't really have any capabilities. but something popped in my head while another panelist was speaking, and then I wanted to pull on it. I love this. Waymo is what I brought up. And it's just what you're talking about, Sunil. And I said, Waymos are going to run over somebody's puppies sooner or later. Right, they're going to kill some people, and unfortunately,
they did. Ran over a cat.
Oh, okay. A cat.
No, they actually did a cat and a dog. Right,
it was a cat.
It was a dog.
Yeah.
As well.
It was at least a cat. I'm not sure.
But they're going to kill some people. Is what I meant to say at some point. And when they do, my opinion, and I think the fact is going to be, they will still be way ahead of like the Uber driver I had on the way to the event. Like they're still going to have a much better safety record. And it's unfortunate, but people will march down to the Waymo office, you know, with torches nonetheless. And as grim as that, you know, as that metaphor is, that's kind of the same thing that happens whenever you patch and take out prod or do anything in security and take out prod. And by the way, this narrative is driving the state of WAF around the planet. Like most WAFs, you don't have any WAF at all. You get hit by audit or TPRM or whatever. How the hell are you going to have a WAF? It's such basics. It's the hygiene. It's the fundamentals. So what do? You get one, and that's done now.
And this
and
is
then
what
you
happens.
Break everything. So you turn off all the settings, and now you still pass that SNF basics fundamentals test.
Yeah.
But you don't. You have a neutered WAF. It's not actually doing anything at all because of the people marching with the torches. So if nothing else, I think when we experience an outage, we need to weigh like, hey, maybe this was prudent. Maybe this was good collateral damage, and we need to not push people the wrong way. So kudos to Cloudflare. And by the way, I mean, having read through that blog, and it's on the heels of a widespread outage that they had, less than a month ago. The fact that when I'm reading the postmortem on it, and by the way, I'm not compensated by Cloudflare in any way. I own some stock of it, so you might say kind of the opposite. I'm the one writing the checks. But when you read through the postmortem, there's code shared by Dane, the CTO. It's just one line, but it's technically their source code. And he's saying, like, you see this line of code that we wrote. And looking at this, it's obvious how this problem manifested and oops. And, like, that level of transparency is just yeah. – I love the fact that they consider that the only way to operate still. I hope they hold on to that.
Do you think the business part of customers will understand that? And sort of, like, I always think that when you have some of these outages, they'll go and blame the security tool. See? We shouldn't have ever used these things. What the fudge? What's going on? And then we have to go play, we CISOs or security leaders have to go play a role of educating folks and explaining to them what we just went through. The Waymo example that you gave is a great example. Do you think that's happening? Or is this just going to go, it's fine. The business has gotten more savvy about this and willing to accept it without creating a lot of pain for us.
Yeah, I think the radical transparency from Cloudflare, maybe they're getting away with it and have gotten away with it for 15 years because their buyer is a engineer, an engineering background. CTO grew up on engineering. And by getting away with it, I mean it's a positive instead of a negative. It's been a selling point. They've grown their business based on this great—
That's a really good point.
If that middleman wasn't there and it was just the CEOs, I don't think they're reading the blog. The reality is their track record's been good on uptime, so it's not like they're having a lot of issues. But I do think it's a net positive and a differentiation from like every other major. They've led the way, right? There are a lot of startups that are starting to do this. But if you compare that to even the CrowdStrike outage, which I think they were pretty transparent over time. They had kind of no choice. It was a partner ecosystem that could tell the story too. But, you know, it took them weeks, months to do what, you know, Cloudflare seems to crank out in like 3 hours after the thing is done.
Yeah, there are a couple things. First, to unpack here. So first is Cloudflare sharing some of that code. It was a small snippet, so I don't know if I would say that's sharing code. But I love Apple's perspective on this. They had a quote way back when, which is, "The security of our products doesn't depend on the secrecy of our source code." That is very true. And so I think similarly with Cloudflare, here's your source code. Go try to deploy a global CDN on top of that, right? This source code. You know, there's a lot more to it than obviously just having the code. One thing I remember from my banking days was we actually did this analysis of what programs caused the most reboots or most system crashes on our Windows machines. Of the top five.
You got to let us guess, man. Don't go there. So, come on.
Of the top five, how many of them do you think were security tools? These were like, you know, doing this was
reboot,
real data.
A reboot.
It's like system crash or, you know, just something where the user environment was significantly disrupted.
Three?
Yeah,
no.
Three.
So no, I would say. Top, really?
It was, yes. Yeah, three out of the five were security products. So
was it like EDRs? What was it? What kind of security tooling?
It was one of the major antivirus companies. It was another VPN. It was a VPN product. And then I forget what the third one was. But anyway, the point is that there's this principle of we try to push for software quality, right? But I would argue that security products are probably some of the worst written code that you can imagine. Plus, they are often to operate in kernel space, kernel mode, not just in user
That's
mode.
That's right. You're right.
So anyway, the general principles of good software engineering should also be learned by security vendors as well.
Yeah. All right. Well, speaking of CrowdStrike, because that one came up in there. They had a really interesting kind of watershed article came out about them catching an insider feeding info to hackers is the way the headline ran. And, you know, just to be 100% clear, this isn't like, CrowdStrike did anything bad or they have a lax program or anything like that. And, you know, once you hire 1,000 people, no less 10,000 or more, you're going to have some schmucks and some people that have gambling debt and some people that are on meth and people are cheating on their wives and all these other things that are going on, and you're going to have some unethical, imprudent behavior.
What do you mean? The background checks didn't work? What are you talking about?
Exactly.
What's wrong with you?
Let's talk about that. Yeah. I mean, in my experience, background checks are like, does the FBI have you down for a crime in the last 12 months or not? And that's not correlated with any of these issues.
So the way I describe this is, you know, when we get a machine, we run a vulnerability scan on the machine, but we don't usually just run it once. We run it every day, every week, I don't know, something, but it's something periodic, right? And when we hire somebody, we do a background check once, and that's it, right? Now, if you're in DOD and you get a security clearance, we run it every 5 years or 10 years, which is still a pretty long time, right?
Right.
But this notion of a vulnerability scan, is which is done routinely, is what I'm kind of referring to here. A background check is a form of a vulnerability scan, right?
That's right.
Are you susceptible to being compromised by, and you list all your, you know, potential hazards, if you will. Now, I think
new
the only reason why we
threats.
Well, these are not emerging in the sense that they're new types of threats. They're like, you know, we know people are motivated by greed and sex and power and you know, whatever, right? So those are
But Sunil, like, yesterday you were a good guy, and today you gamble your money away last night, and now you become a new threat because Sunil was good yesterday, but today he's not because of something that happened. Is that your point?
Well, the point being, I think we in security would be happy to live to operate in a totalitarian, you know, information state inside of an enterprise, but I think most of us would not want to live in such an organization or a country, right? I had an article way back in the day, which is, do we want our information security program to look more like North Korea or like Norway? And I think many of our security programs, we actually want them to look like North Korea. I mean, think of it like what North Korea does, right? Mm-hmm. All your devices are instrumented, and there's a gold image that you have to use. And if you violate a certain policy, punishment can include up to termination. Okay. Now, termination in an enterprise view has a slightly different meaning than termination in North Korea, but you get the idea, right? I think we do mimic a very authoritarian type of countries when it comes to our security program. And when it comes to background checks, there's a balance that we have to strike, right? We just have to recognize that no one's going to want to work for us in any given company if we operate like North Korea.
Yeah. You know, it's important. I would highlight also on a CrowdStrike article that CrowdStrike made a point that the attack didn't gain any access to really important information or data or access to services. So they were able to nip it in early on without creating that much damage. The thing that worries me is that the person did this, the insider, for $25,000. Think about how much money we spend in security budgets, millions potentially of dollars for somebody, you know, but I think this has always been the reality, right? Just somebody with, you know, $10,000, $25,000 internal resource that can bypass all these amazing controls that we may have. And we spend a lot of money on.
That's right. And like Sunil, I love the metaphor with the vuln scanning and the machines. And I'll take it further. And for one, like I'll say, to your point, continuous checks is the right evolutionary path on that. And I've seen companies that do, and to do continuous background checks, you don't ping the FBI database more frequently because that's still a really lagging indicator. And most of the bad things you do don't get to that level. So the startups I've seen in space use social media and are actually polling, because, by the way, when you get on meth, you can tell.
Just to be clear, authoritarian countries also have a similar mechanism, and they use a social credit score as an equivalent mechanism to keep people in check. So, you know, it is very, in this case, Orwellian versus, who's the other guy who wrote Brave New World? But anyway, the point is that it for some authoritarian countries and for some enterprises, it does definitely have this sort of social credit. You know, we would love to have such a social credit score so that we can figure out that this person did just go gamble and now they've become a new threat for the enterprise.
Well, and we have that ability in private companies, you know. And
yes, the ability's there. It's a question of will we choose to exercise it, knowing that that will create a a lot of backlash from employees.
That is such an excellent point. So, doing monitoring social media, monitoring some of these external chats, forums that people public. Mind you, of what our employees were actually accessing and talking about to ensure, you know, like what you guys are talking about. But the HR's departments and the legal departments in organizations that I've been pushed back heavily. They didn't want them. And so instead what we did was, okay, fine. Then we'll look at behavior, what they do on a daily basis and see if anything changes. And okay, that might be a pirate victory. I get it. But when you just do that, or looking at behavior, you know, somebody with this kind of elevated privilege, and I'm assuming that's what they had in CrowdStrike or whatever the privilege was, given that access, what looks normal, it could be normal, in other words. You just give a bad guy access to what you've done, what access you already had. It's harder to pick those off initially. I think Sunil's highlights a very important point. You do have to look at things like their social media. But we're not allowed to do that. In practice, many companies don't allow us to do that. So we have to monitor their behaviors internally instead.
Hold on. I just want to make sure you understand. There's a difference between being not allowed, and we can say we security team were not allowed to do it, versus choosing to not do it. Okay. And I think the key point here is one perspective is a moral and ethical question. Okay. The other one's a technical question. Hey, we can't do it because, maybe either technically we can't or technically we've not turned it on. But I think the real question is fundamentally more of a moral and ethical question. Is this something that we actually want to do, and are we willing to pay for the corresponding? I mean, it's a risk management. This is fundamentally a risk management decision, right? We know that we could do this, but we choose not to because it's just not the culture that we want to have.
The biggest pain I had with employees was when we put in our policy that we're monitoring their activities, and we were trying to be very transparent, but not monitoring. And we tried to be a little bit more detailed without getting too much into the weeds. But monitoring using your CrowdStrike tool or your proxy, whatever that was, right? I almost had a rebellion from employees. Because they thought we were capturing their keystrokes and watching what they were typing and entering. And I had especially our European employees, I had literally had to get in front of a bunch of employees and say, no, that's not what we're doing. I really don't have the time to be looking at everything you're typing. But I have to tell you, I'm monitoring your laptops because that's what I have to do policy-wise. I have to let you know.
Yeah. I think we touched on something really, really important too, which is like, entities are bad not because of who they are or what they are, but because of what they do. And that's true of the virus on the laptop too. Like, behavioral is what saved the day at the end of that. But separately from that, when it comes to vuln scanning, right? Let's pull on that thread with the metaphor even more. I didn't vuln scan laptops. When I got them or ever, I thought it was stupid and a waste of time. I was very interested if a laptop tried to exfiltrate a bunch of data or, move laterally and all that kind of stuff. I didn't vuln scan it and say, oh, there's no vulns, and then go back to bed. And that's really the bottom of zero trust, right? And what it will come out of this CrowdStrike article in particular is, do so many employees need to have access to that data, right? Should we rate limit the amount of records? I don't even know that it's relevant here, but that a single individual can pull. And I think that's more sustainable and durable, is to assume breach. Assume the laptop is going to get malware one day and then make sure the damage you can do is limited. Assume the employee's going to start doing meth one day and make it obvious and detectable that they're starting to try to, pull a bunch of data in time where you could save it before it becomes a problem. So I think that's the takeaway. All right. It's
prediction season, right? So annual reports are all coming out. Comcast had a Comcast Business Cybersecurity Threat Report coming out, full of a lot of little tidbits. Some more obvious than others. But one of the things that was in there was that they highlighted the trend in the number of CVEs, and forgive me, it must have been over a certain score, important ones, that over the last 5 years, and it's basically showing that it keeps on going up. And I think the quick, like kind of brutal analysis is that security is more important than ever, and there's more and more vulnerabilities than ever. Is that true, or are we just looking more? Does it even matter? Does the correlation, is there any correlation between count and interest and urgency?
Well, okay, so there's a fundamental fallacy called the base rate fallacy, which is this, I won't go into the details, but the main question here is, what's the denominator? Okay, is the denominator growing? In which case, of course, the number of CVEs is going to grow. All right. So that's one potential factor. I'm pretty certain that the denominator has grown year after year. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially with open source, which is where these mostly are.
Yes. And so if you consider the denominator, might it actually be decreasing percentage-wise? And it's, you know, that's one can argue that it might actually be decreasing, which is great. The other consideration is that there's also another philosophical question, which I think has largely been answered, but it's a philosophical question, which is, are vulnerabilities sparse or are they dense? Okay. Sparse or are they dense? Because they have some interesting repercussions if it's one or the other. If it's sparse, then we should actually spend a lot of time finding vulnerabilities because we want to get rid of them as much as possible. But if they're dense, it means that it's essentially never ending. In fact, it actually may not be a good thing for us to go find some vulnerabilities because to actively find vulnerabilities because we'll just keep finding more, right? Now, you mentioned that this is a certain, maybe these are class, you know, like if you're, there's a follow-on question, which is, are CVSS 10 vulnerabilities, are they sparse or are they dense? And most of us, of course, are hoping that they're sparse. But there's also a view that they are also dense, but the level of effort to find them is much higher, okay? But AI just entered the chat, okay?
Yeah.
And so what we see, I think we'll have an answer to, are CVSS 10 vulnerabilities sparse or dense? Because I'm sure we'll see more CVSS 10 vulnerabilities too. Now, the React one that we saw earlier, I don't know if that was AI discovered. But we'll see.
No, sure. I don't think it was.
Yeah, I don't think it was either.
But can we all? I mean, I hate to be looking at an annual reports. I look at them, but and I review them. But I don't want to get caught up too much in the year to year thing or the particular year. But I do kind of look at trends. But it is a little weird, right? That from 2023 to 2024, if my math. And sorry, I got to do some quick math. It's not my best subject, but that looks like a big jump compared to the previous years. Maybe, right from 2020 to 2021, 2022. Maybe Sunil's right. Maybe, I don't know if Sunil's saying that, but maybe AI is making a difference, finding more of these vulnerabilities.
No way.
I don't know. But that's a big jump, though. That's a huge jump.
It's possible. But I mean, this is 2024, too, that thing.
I think to Sunil's point, you got to look at 2025 and see that, right?
Well, right. I mean, come on, it's 2025. Get the freaking data right. But good point is like in relative versus absolute numbers when it comes to sensational statistical data. And like this happens all the time. Like anybody who's in the news business always gets the raw data, the absolute, and then the relative data and the percentage, and then picks the one that's going to get more likes and clicks, unfortunately. And what we got here is the absolute values. And when you get an absolute value, I'm always like, people are like, 1.5 million people died of lung cancer in Kansas or whatever. I'm like, I don't know. I'm not moved by that. What's normal? Yeah. How many people are there in Kansas, right?
Yeah. So there's two values that are important here. I mentioned the denominator already. The second value is the number of eyeballs. Okay. And to Mario's point earlier, if we have a whole bunch of new AI eyeballs and vulnerabilities are dense, then we should also expect to see a higher number of vulnerabilities. So it's, I think it is entirely possible that this 11,000 jump, 11,000 additional CVEs that were discovered between 2023 and 2024 could have been from AI-assisted tooling, because you can treat that as more eyeballs. So even if the number, if the denominator were to be the same, which it wasn't, but you know, let's assume it was the same, just because you have more eyeballs, if vulnerabilities are dense, you'll see more.
Yeah. You know, I just to highlight on this report, and this is what practice that I do, and I'm sure all of us did this or do this on a regular basis. I tend to go to the business websites, so CNBC, because I want to make sure that I know what my CFO, what my CEO, what my CIO are looking at. Because if this is on their front page of CNBC highlighted, that's what they're going to gravitate to. So I want to make sure I understand, oh yeah, I've saw that already. It's noise. Don't worry about it. Clickbait.
Yeah, you don't, it's all about, that's such a theme, but like all about reacting to the news without being defensive or dismissive. So the only way to do that is, yeah, I've seen it already. Yeah, well, it'll get us. Half the job of a CISO is really just reacting to the weaponization of statistical data by media organizations or vendors, actually, even worse. All right, so speaking of AI, and by the way, I don't think that the number in 2024 data set could be that influenced by AI discovery of these, since that's really just starting to break ground here at the end of 2025. But AI and active use by adversaries. So Anthropic dropped an article. There was a bunch of them we talked about in the last episode that we were kind of throwing some water on, like, it's not really here yet. And Anthropic is saying, like, okay, now we got something pretty hot. And they documented use of Claude code to create a whole attack, a whole campaign with success. And they really, in my mind, focused a lot on, here's what we do here at Anthropic to keep this from happening. Here's where we need to improve, and here's why we're going to improve. But the whole idea is, to me, is like, we own this massive weapon of mass destruction, and we're responsible for securing it, just like AWS, right? They did this with limiting what you can do out of their infrastructure, whether you could relay spam or whether you could do vulnerability scanning and so on. And that's that. But one of the questions that comes up to me is, like, even if Anthropic and OpenAI make it near impossible to utilize their LLMs for nefarious purposes, and I'm not sure they will, that's not good enough, right? I mean, that's just the open platforms. But, I mean, we know that the right motivated and resourced adversary isn't under any of those constraints, right? So is this a watershed moment to you guys?
So I totally agree with you, especially with respect to the use of unconstrained or uncensored tools, if you will, uncensored LLMs, if you will, that the attackers will be using that are going to be as capable, if not more, going to be like, give it two more years, and the ones that we find to be extraordinarily capable today are going to be less capable than the open source ones 2 years from now. So that point being, the fundamental conclusion of that point is, whatever controls that the frontier models are trying to put in to avoid that happening from the frontier models, it's kind of missing the point. What you really need to just consider is that these orchestrated agentic systems are able to complete their tasks, the tasks that we're assigning them to do, with a greater degree of success. And whether that is a business task or a cybersecurity task or a cyber attack task, we're starting to see it becoming more and more successful. Now, there's absolutely failure modes, and we see that in business use cases just as much as we see it in cybersecurity use cases, as much as we see it in cyber attack use cases. But as we're starting to learn how to make the business use cases more reliable, okay, or how we make our coding assistance more reliable, those same practices will absolutely apply to these attack systems, and we'll see the results, you know, accordingly. Hopefully we'll have similar defensive systems and defensive techniques that will come alongside that as well.
Within guardrails.
Yeah. So here, I'll throw out a prediction. It's almost 2026. These are usually kind of worthless because you're either so generic that, of course, they're going to come true, or they're so crazy that nobody even wants to hear you talk about them. But I think this is a good one. I don't know if it'll be 2026, probably, if not 2027. I bet there will be a massive, widespread, distributed LLM that has no guardrails on it, that all of the bad guys know and talk about and use, and it'll be like the cult of the dead cow of LLMs, or it'll be on Telegram and like operationalized through a distributed network like that or whatever. But I bet there will be a household name with constant cat and mouse takedowns, and we'll all know that the bad guys can use, you know, Fancy Cat or whatever the hell it's going to be called.
Yeah.
Anytime to make sarin gas and or to write exploits. And it'll be a household term by certainly the end of 2027, whatever the hell that thing is called.
Well, I was thinking about our previous vulnerability statement that you were making, Jerry, between 23 and 24. And you were saying, I don't think that's noise. It may not be AI related. Maybe 2 years from now, we were going to talk about AI moving the needle. Maybe that is the technology that moves the needle.
Yeah. So, Neil, did you have a reaction to that prediction?
Oh, yeah. I think it already happened in 2024.
What was it called? That's a cute name.
I don't know. Pick one. DeepSeek, Llama.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. Open source models and you're done.
Yeah. I mean, even like GPT-OSS is pretty capable. You just got to find, it's just, if you want to run the bigger models, you just need more hardware, right? And that's getting cheaper, bigger, so on, so on. So I would say it's already there.
I mean, you know how resource hijacking is what we call it, right? The general cyber activity that's meant to either relay spam, mine crypto, or participate in LLM training, if nothing else. I think that at least will be a pattern for sure. Like your botnets won't be just doing DDoS anymore.
I don't know about LLM training. That's I don't know if that's going to – the return on that is not as evident as crypto mining.
Yeah. All right, cool. So that's a perfect segue because, like, when you talked about return, and I'm thinking about, like, my immediate thought, I didn't want to go into it at the time, but I'm going to use it to bridge over to this topic now, was the return on investment is kind of infinite when you have no cost. And so that's why distributed compromised networks don't have to have a really great return. Like, you know, when you steal somebody, like, when it comes to mining crypto, if you're doing anybody else's hardware, you could do it any time and it's kind of worth it. I think that will come to bear on this story. So Wall Street Journal ran an article that we're looking at on our screens that said uncertain economy takes toll on cybersecurity teams, and go through it, man. I could have just guessed it from the title, but it's basically saying like cyber spend is, well, I'll call in air quotes, down. And the reason I'm using air quotes is because growing at a lower rate is what we call down these days. It's, again, the denominator's always growing too. But it's basically saying that CISO salaries are frozen, if not down, security team growth and all of that. And people blame this either on uncertain economy in this case or AI. A lot of other people say, oh, it's AI displacing labor. And I think it's premature, but people might use that as an excuse to do layoffs they always wanted to do now and hoping that that'll give them some air cover and buffer. I have some interesting reactions to this in terms of ROI of cybersecurity in general, but do you guys see this? Do you think this is as accurate, as reflective of today, and or have any, you know, armchair quarterback explanations for it?
Let's go back to the notion of the base rate again. Uncertain economy takes toll on teams, like just generally, right? Take any team in business, or even actually not just any team, any back office team, okay? Because, you know, cybersecurity is a back office function. The question is it taking a toll on HR? Is it taking a toll on legal teams? Is it taking a toll on fill in the blank? And I think the answer is yes, almost universally. So cybersecurity, I don't think is necessarily special just because of this. And AI is definitely a factor. But the uncertainty in the economy, you know, the administration doing things that doesn't necessarily give us a way to confidently predict what our next quarter's revenue might be. Certainly makes it much harder to maintain any sort of predictive capability when it comes to you know what the quarterly earnings might be for the next quarter.
You know, I was watching a business news channel, and they were talking about how the recent grad situations coming out of college and not finding jobs, finding difficulty in finding jobs. I think we've talked about this before. And they quickly highlighted the top 10 jobs that people should be looking for during this time of uncertainty. And number 4 or 5 was security analysts. So meanwhile, we're looking at some of these reports saying that, you know, our budgets are frozen or declining and we can't hire enough security, or security people can't hire security people. Meanwhile, we're telling people this is the future. This is what the jobs are, security analysts.
Yeah. You know, what I would say is that disciplines and areas that have a uncertain ROI are a lot more sensitive to economic contraction. It's like kind of at a high level, right? So, and I think that's, like it or not, that's true. I know in venture, we talk about the magic number and basically the return on revenue spend. So like when you're building out revenue teams and salespeople, it's like, oh, for every dollar I spend on sales, I can get $1.20. Like, yay, let's go get $3. You get 80 cents. They want to, you're not investable. Right. And the idea is it's time to pour fuel on the fire when the magic number is greater than one. And that's the problem for security. The magic number for security is below one. You throw more money into security, you don't get more security, and you certainly don't get a direct correlation. And because of that pattern, when there's any uncertainty and where are we going to have more growth and money, we're sure as hell not going to do it on these things that have a magic number of less than one. And that's just the case in almost risk management writ large, but certainly in cybersecurity. Our ROI proof is just really hard. And no one should leave there going, oh, I'm going to fix that problem. I'm going to figure out ROI. It's not about the solutions. It's just, you know, the data set. We're talking about highly unlikely, high impact events. And even when they succeed, you can't directly say why. And when they fail, you can't directly prove the negative on how you manage to prevent it using your investment. So I'm not too surprised about seeing this. And I think it's accurate and people are drawn back a little bit.
I just worry about, you know, where do we see a reduction of talent and available talent for security in the next 2, 3, 4 years, and we're going to find ourselves in this, you know, the hard thing is how do you predict in the future and what things are going to look like? But I find that I continue to worry about recent grads, and we're losing the potential of using those folks.
Yeah, but you know, like for every cybersecurity, oh, don't be a SOC analyst because AI is going to do that. That resonates with us because we're in that business and we're talking to friends who are building agentic SOC.
Yeah.
And if not deploying it ourselves and so on. But now imagine someone running the general ledger, you know, an accountant or something like that. Like, of course, they're shot. So actually, if you're looking for the top 10 jobs, that cyber analyst under fire from AI is still a lot more important and needed and uncertain that they're going to be replaced than all those other jobs that are available out there.
I think any job that requires constant remaking of oneself is going to be a job that will be there in the future as well. And cybersecurity in general has been of that flavor. And the reason why is because we constantly introduce new attack surfaces. Okay. And these new attack surfaces, I don't mean just like, oh, we just roll out another 100,000 Windows workstations. I mean, we just rolled out 100,000 new widgets that we just bought off, you know, of some company that was selling it for business productivity, and it's all the new hotness, okay? And so that new attack surface requires a creativity on the part of defenders to figure out, okay, how do we defend these things as well? Anyway, the point is that if you operate in a place with constant change, then and you are of the type that can adjust to that change on a regular basis, then you're already better off. With respect to cybersecurity folks, I think my concern with the folks growing up in the current generation with cybersecurity is, you know, there's the old guard, which is like I guess us, we grew up in a time and place when we had to learn it ourselves because there was no one to teach us. But now we have a whole bunch of classes and curriculum and all that kind of stuff. And the curiosity that comes into, well, how does this actually work?
Yeah.
Isn't really there anymore. It's just like, hey, push this button, right?
Yeah, so true.
I think you're totally right. Yeah, and you know, at the same time, what's really weird is job creation is not a moral imperative, but particular when you're in like defensive risk management and cyber. Like the reality is that we should be celebrating less jobs. We should be trying to work ourselves and the whole industry out of a job. I mean, we're trying to solve the problem, right? It can't lose sight of that. And solving the problem means less jobs, like it or not. So we can't be crying around that AI is taking jobs in cyber. Now, when it comes to like the Amazon warehouse, there is an argument at some point where they go, yeah, I know robots can do all of this, but it's really hard on the local community. So will you throw them a bone and delay that deployment? And there is some moral imperative there, especially at a certain scale.
But my recommendation is become a plumber.
Yeah.
It's not, I mean, that's just not going to go, that's not going to go away. You know what I mean? It's expensive and I know it stinks, but you know, it literally stinks. But
oh, dude,
it's
you're
not
right.
Gonna
and
go
if you
away
actually
yet.
Answer the call and show up on time, then poof, nobody could touch you. I agree. All right. Well, good. Well, thanks, guys. It's been a while now, and I'm glad we can end on that note about plumbing. yeah, but hopefully we'll get another one in before the holidays. And this has been great. And hopefully we don't have too many catastrophic actions and job creation acts in the interim. But good seeing you guys, and take care until next time.
Thanks. See ya.